too, and he's still paralyzed.
Health and Human Services Budget Committee will come to order, and we're really very happy today to be able to have a lot of information from the Mental Health Division in the Department of Human Services. And we're going to start because the department earlier when they were with us about this said they were in the planning stages and by the end of the year they would have completed their plan. So we're asking them to come back and talk about not only the reorganization of services at the Anoka Regional Treatment Center, but also the realignment of services in the rest of the system because of the governor's unallotment. And so we'll begin with that. Welcome to our committee, Commissioner.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Dr. Reed Sulik, Assistant Commissioner for the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration for the Department of Human Services. I'm going to speak briefly and then introduce to you a few people we have lined up from my administration to present some detailed information in response to the requests. But just to, in looking at the agenda forward and how we prepared the PowerPoint, let me show you what we had prepared as far as the order, and if we need to rearrange the order, you can direct us.
Oh, if this order isn't okay with you, this is what we...
What you just put down there? Great. Then let me walk you through, if you go to your second slide.
Just so we know who's talking to us, so
got
we
it.
Can talk
I'm
to
gonna,
them
I'm
going to
ask John Zockel to present to you. You all have met Mr. Zockel before as our budget and legislative director for our administration, to present a brief overview over the mental health initiative, because we were asked to provide an update on that, but also then to talk specifically about the preferred integrated networks, which is the PINs,
okay.
And give you a status update.
So we're going to start with number two.
Yes.
On the agenda.
And
Fine.
Then following Mr. Zockel's presentation, I'll have Sharon Audio, who is our adult mental health division director, present an update on specific adult mental health grants and updates from the Adult Mental Health Initiative. Following her quick presentation, we'll have Glennis Edwall, our Children's Mental Health Division Director, present some specific updates on the Children's Mental Health Initiative. We thought that that would provide the overarching overview of everything going on, at least the highlights of what's going on within our administration affecting the entire state, and couching then the updates on the state-operated services redesign. I'm going to ask Mike Tesner, the Chief Executive Officer, and also Sharon Audio, the Adult Mental Health Division Director, to come and jointly present some specific updates on that process. I'm going to stay at the table throughout the entire presentation for questions, and I'm just going to ask John to go ahead and begin.
And then we'll do the mental health PCA.
Yes, then the PCA
update last.
Update will be last, if that's
all right.
Okay.
That's fine.
And then we'll have the continuing care division present that information.
Okay.
I think just to introduce you to the slides, you all have seen every time I've presented to you, I've brought back our seven goals of excellence. That's sort of the overarching principles that we are really trying to align the entire administration under. Just a quick review, essentially the first and top priority of everything that we see needs to be going on in our administration across the state needs to be moving towards the eradication of the stigma of mental illness and addictions. The second would be improving access to the right care at the right time at the right location. The third, around the implementation of quality standards of care across providers and across the state, and the fourth being the integration of services across primary care in addition to mental health care and addiction care and social services, housing, et cetera. I just want to also emphasize that, we can go ahead and flip forward to the next slide, that we're well aware of the disparities that do exist. The Department of Health and the Department of Human Services have strong efforts in light of these budget issues that we're all under, but still being cognizant of the disparities in overall health care and particularly in mental health care. And I just want to emphasize that this is something that we are continuously being thoughtful of as we are moving forward in our organization and our administration. So, John, I'm going to ask you to just go ahead and begin with the overview of the Mental Health Initiative and then the PINs.
Thank you, Dr. Sulik. Madam Chair, Don Allen is out sick today, so he sends his regrets that he wasn't able to be here.
Tell him we hope he feels better soon.
Thank you. Thank you. It's important to place the rest of our presentation in the context of the 2007 Mental Health Initiative. As committee members know, this was the most significant piece of mental health legislation since the passage of the original Mental Health Act in 1987. Some of you might not know that Senator Berglund was the lead Senate author not only of this latest initiative, but the original Mental Health Act as well. And, Senator, we certainly appreciate your leadership through these years. You've helped us build a solid foundation for the future. There were three main components to the 2007 Mental Health Initiative. Part one was a consistent benefit set to have the same mental health services covered across all of the public health care programs. The second part was what we called preferred integrated networks, and I'll say a bit more about that later because that was a key item that was asked to be on the agenda. And the third part were the infrastructure investments. The first and the third part, the benefit set and the infrastructure investments, were where the new funding went. That was to cover the gaps for services that were not covered and services that did not exist. And you'll hear more also later about the infrastructure investments. I have a slide on the benefit set. You can see which services are now covered in all of the public health care programs. That transition has now happened. It was a phase-in, and those are now the covered services in all of the public health care programs. Here's just some brief bullets on the preferred integrated networks, and I'll say more about that later. And then some quick bullets on the children's infrastructure investments. You'll hear more about them, as well as the adults. Okay. The preferred integrated networks, as I said, were the one part of the Mental Health Initiative that did not have significant new funding. This was the reform part of the Mental Health Initiative. We heard a lot of concern about how fragmented the system was, the silos, physical health being separate from mental health and separate from social services. And the feeling was that we needed a major effort to reform how services were provided, how the accountability worked. And so this idea of preferred integrated networks was developed to look at the whole person. And as you see in the third bullet, the language in the legislation was that these were going to be projects to demonstrate the integration of physical and mental health services within prepaid health plans and their coordination with social service. What are PIMS? PIMS are based on an operating partnership between counties and at least one or more managed care organizations. It's a local design. What do they do? They provide comprehensive coverage for mental health services and physical health care for people with mental illness who would otherwise be in fee-for-service medical assistance. They also integrate Medicare coverage for those individuals who are on both MA and Medicare, including the Medicare drug coverage. And they provide integrated care coordination and case management to facilitate access to both health care and social services. Key functions, they're required to conduct a health risk screening for each member upon enrollment. They offer various ways to integrate physical and mental health care. They work to get enrollees in for annual physicals, preventative care, and so on, as part of this process of integrating physical and mental health care. Okay, so how did we decide who is going to be a PIN? Under the legislation, we were allowed to approve up to three projects to cover not more than 40% of the state. This was probably the most controversial part of the 2007 mental health initiatives. There were concerns about doing something different, and so part of the compromise was to put some limits on how much of this would be done. Not more than three projects, not more than 40% of the state. We got additional stakeholder input after the legislation was passed. We issued a request for proposals, and we did get three proposals from managed care county partnerships, Metro Health Plan and Hennepin County, Medica and Dakota County, and the Prime West county-based purchasing health plan, and their the counties that you see listed on the slide. This past June, we reached agreement with Medica and Dakota County to begin their preferred integrated network, and they began enrollment of their clients in September. Prime West withdrew from negotiations in August, and we're continuing to negotiate with Metro Health Plan and Hennepin County. Okay, some more details on the one that is up and running now. As I said, they began enrolling members in September. They now have 486 enrollees. And part of what they've done is to reconfigure how case management works so that case managers are now wellness navigators with the ability to be a single point of contact for access to mental health care, physical health care, and social services. They're providing opportunities for co-location of mental health and physical health care at three key sites. And early indications are that these health screenings and other integrated services that they're providing are identifying many unmet physical health needs, and that these navigators are improving access to both physical and mental health services. Some challenges that we're finding is that the enrollment process that was laid out in statute has turned out to be somewhat problematic. If you recall, the way this was set up was that the statute provides for preferential enrollment, which means that if somebody meets the criteria, we automatically enroll them unless they opt out. And the way it's worked out is that a number of people have opted out, and looking back, we're almost wondering if it might have been better to just simply make it voluntary. But that's one of the ideas for future possible changes. Another challenge that's come up is the issue of risk, and this has had the most to do with Prime West dropping out and not having an agreement with Hennepin County yet. There's a concern that this population has been so underserved that as they do this more aggressive effort to screen everybody and evaluate what they need, that particularly initially, they may have to provide more services than what has been provided in the past. But the funding for these projects is based on what medical assistance would otherwise have provided. So if you recall, there's not additional money that was provided for here. The idea was to use the existing funding more effectively. But that's where the concern is. Is there a risk that particularly initially these projects might have to provide more funding than more services than the funding that's provided? Next steps, we may look at a transition to a voluntary enrollment or a change in how the preferential process works. We will be finalizing an evaluation plan and contracting with a qualified external review organization, developing experience in terms of estimating the cost in this kind of a structure and looking at possible ways to address the concerns about risk. And we'll be working on plans for a possible re-release of the request for proposal The legislation allows for additional projects to be considered as long as we're not up to those maximums that I mentioned earlier, the three projects and 40%. And at this point, we're certainly well below that. Any questions on that before we go over to the adult mental health infrastructure investments?
Mr. Zakel, do you have any idea when you will know whether you're going to be entering into a project with Hennepin County?
Madam Chair, no, I do not. It depends on how those negotiations go.
Do you even have like a projected timeline or?
Madam Chair, all I can say that I'm aware of is they're live and still ongoing. So there's just not been agreement on either the department side or the Hennepin County and the MHP side. Regarding some of the risk that Mr. Zocklin mentioned, I think that's the part that they're still negotiating over regarding rates and some assumption of the risk. But what I would say is the fact that it's still ongoing feels hopeful to me. I'm hopeful that we can get there. I don't have a timeline, though. I would like to see it sooner as opposed to later, as I'm sure you all would as well.
Well, you know, when the legislation was passed, we had no idea that we'd be still talking about implementing it 3 years later. So, and, of course, part of the idea was to try to develop a model that maybe we would want to take statewide if it is better for people with mental illness to get their mental health and physical health coordinated. Then we should be trying to think ahead as to how we would do that for all people with mental illness in Minnesota.
Yes.
Who are in our public programs.
Madam Chair.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Suka, is the 10-county plan, is that dead in the water? Is there another option?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, that's my understanding that at this point they've broken off the proposal, and they're looking at other ways to accomplish some of the same things.
Other questions? Okay, let's go on then.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask.
Oh, one more question.
Sure.
The enrollment in Dakota County started in September, and it stood at 486. Do you have any idea what you, at least in the planning phase, anticipated the enrollment would grow to?
Madam Chair, yeah, I believe that's expected to be about what it's going to level off at for the time being.
I see. Okay.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask Sharon Audio to come to the table. She's our Adult Mental Health Division Director. We're going to start with slide 20, I guess, just so you guys can follow along. Sharon.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sharon Audio. I'm the Director of Adult Mental Health. What I'm going to do in just a brief period of time is to focus particularly on some of the intensive services that were implemented as a result of the 2007 mental health initiative. We have a much more comprehensive set of services, and we can certainly provide a summary to you, but given the time, I thought what we would talk about more particularly is some of the intensive services. The first that you'll see here is crisis services. Thank you to the legislature for providing some funding for us. We now have 13 regional grants, and the services vary in part due to, I think, geography, but most of them have mobile crisis teams, which involves people being able to go out to the person's home or to other settings and deal with the crisis at that particular time. Crisis stabilization services are either residential services or can be provided in people's homes. The healthcare navigator is a new approach, and it's something that we've looked at in terms of the ability to have someone help a person who comes to crisis services with perhaps no health care insurance. And one of their goals is to look at, are there ways to help people get enrolled in any particular program that might be available to help with funding as well as additional services. And then lastly, the rapid access to prescribers. one of the things that we found has been very valuable is that often people need to see either a psychiatrist or an advanced practice nurse for follow-up for medication, and we've been able to provide that in some parts of the state. However, with a shortage of psychiatrists and advanced practice nurses, that's been a challenge. It's about $4.2 million a year, and you'll see here for some outcomes. We've done this based on episodes for the first three quarters. We've served about, of 2009, about 4,300 people. Of that number of episodes, 476 were referred to inpatient services. So I think the crisis services are really being effective. And referred to rapid access psychiatry or prescribers was 511 of those episodes. And then the last is that a little over 1,225 people also received additional mental health services, and that was at the point of referral. So many of those people who also got intensive services also received crisis service. The next service I want to talk about is a sort of community treatment. Many of you are perhaps aware of this. This is an evidence-based practice. Many people call it hospital without walls. It's a 24/7, 365 team, multidisciplinary team, often headed by a psychiatrist or an advanced practice nurse, who really focus on doing whatever it takes to help people stay in the community. The population that is focused on these sort of community treatment teams are really the people with the most challenging behaviors in the community. So it's not anyone who has a serious mental illness, but people who are really having real struggles, people who use emergency rooms a lot, people who are homeless with serious mental illness, people with dual disorders, mental health, substance abuse, who really have some challenges staying in the community. We have 27 teams across the state. 14 are in the metro area, 13 in greater Minnesota. The staff-to-patient ratio is about 1 to 10 in the metro and 1 to 8 in greater Minnesota because of geography. So they're really very intensive, small teams of professionals. It is a Medicaid-reimbursable benefit. We've served a little over 2,000 in 2008, and I think one of the outcomes that's really impressive that I've listed here is that we were able to look at about roughly 1,400 people who 1 year prior to involvement in the assertive community treatment teams and 1 year after, and there was a 42% reduction in inpatient. And for those who needed hospitalization, there was about a 50% reduction in total bed days. That's one of the outcome measures that's used really across the country in terms of looking at the effectiveness of assertive community treatment teams. So we're really doing quite well, I think, with the intent of that. The next, what we found when we implemented assertive community treatment is that many smaller communities or areas with less population base were really interested in having assertive community treatment. And it really was not an effective, cost-effective model, nor did they have the population size to really make up a team. So what we are piloting is what's called intensive community rehab services. It's a model very similar to assertive community treatment, but without all the kind of requirements that are needed to make it an evidence-based practice. So you don't have to have a psychiatrist time as much as you do for ACT teams. And some of the other team members are not as crucial in terms of number of hours for this model. And it tends to work really well in greater Minnesota, where there's a shortage of providers. We're piloting this in five sites. Four of them are in greater Minnesota. One is in the metropolitan area. And we're also looking at this as perhaps a step down from the more intensive sort of community treatment. It's just been up and going a little less than a year. We've served about 250 people, and the number of people who are being served range from about 29 to a little over 100. It's funded in two ways. One, we've used some of the infrastructure funding that we had available as startup costs, and we're also looking at how can we use Medicaid services to help support this program. And the outcomes are very impressive as well. They're starting to show a reduction in hospital bed days. So we're really optimistic about looking at this as potentially a model for other parts of the state that are more rural and really are not able to sustain an assertive community treatment team. The next one I wanted to highlight is integrated dual disorder treatment. This is another evidence-based practice that's recognized nationally. We estimate that about 50% of the people with serious mental illness also have a co-occurring substance abuse disorder. When you look at people who are in jails and prisons, it tends to be about 70%. And on the substance abuse side, we're often finding people who present with substance abuse who also have some mental health issues that may not raise to the level of serious mental illness, but have depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and others. So we've been working on a model to really do some enhanced treatment for adults who are dually diagnosed with what's called a no-wrong door policy, which means that whichever door they come into, whether it's mental health or substance abuse, people will have the skills and expertise to begin to do some treatment for people. The research shows that parallel treatment, where you go to both at the same time, or you go to one service model first, complete that, and then go to the other, is not workable, and it's not been effective. This has been shown to be highly effective. It's in place right now. It's operational in 25 mental health and substance abuse clinics, also one American Indian Behavioral Health Service, and two DOC facilities, Stillwater and Shakopee. We're also interested in beginning to look at this model. And as we move forward, we also felt it was critically important to also look at hospitals, because we need to do more about continuity of care so that people are receiving these services in the community if they're hospitalized, or vice versa, they begin their work around this in hospitals. So we're currently developing some screening and assessment tools in four community hospitals, Regions in St. Paul, Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis, CentraCare in St. Cloud, and St. Joe's Hospital in St. Paul, and then one community behavioral health unit hospital in St. Peter, and one unit at Anoka. And it's been a real challenge for hospitals because, you know, they're very busy and they're really having to change the way in which they provide services, but they're all very committed to moving forward. And to make those kinds of changes really takes at least a couple of years of really buy-in administratively and some change in the process. The next that we've done some work on is crisis intervention team training. I believe you've probably heard about this before. This is really targeted to law enforcement and dispatchers. And what we wanted to do was to train law enforcement to be more sensitive to and improve their responses to adults who have a mental illness. We have trained, as you'll see here, about 235 law enforcement officers representing 39 counties, many of which across the state. And we've also realized that you have to train dispatchers. So we've done a modified training of dispatchers of 155. And what we're hearing anecdotally, we don't have any hard data yet, is that there really is improved coordination between law enforcement and mental health in terms of providing better services to people. There is one more that I want to mention that's not in your slides, but is the depression care study. And this is a project. This is a work that we've been doing as a public-private partnership with several of our large health provider networks, behavioral health networks like Allina Health Partners, Mayo, and a number of mental health centers that are working together to really do some work around earlier intervention with people with depression, doing some evaluation of clinical outcomes, and that's also been very effective. I want to just very quickly cover, I think we've made some progress in this, but as many of you have seen, we also did the Intensive Needs Task Force in 2009, which you received the report in March. And I want to highlight just some key findings from that report, as well as some recommendations. It was a recommended study by the legislature, a steering committee of 17 stakeholders that represented advocates, consumers, family members, hospitals, counties, providers, got together to begin to look at, really the focus was on acute care capacity, hospital bed capacity. We had a steering committee of the 17 members, and then we had three work groups, an adult work group, a children's work group, which you'll hear about from Dr. Edwald, and a workforce work group. And I want to just highlight some of the findings on the adult side that came from this group. The first is, at the time we did this, we really felt that there was adequate number of psychiatric beds, that the issue was access. And what we were hearing from hospitals and many people is that it was difficult to get into a hospital, often because there were people sitting in hospitals who could be discharged from hospitals. So there was a backlog at the hospital side. That crisis services, although they were developed, were not completely up and going yet, and that was having some impact on the pressure on the hospitals. That there really was a lack of a full range of housing with supports. I think we've done a great deal in terms of people living in apartments, but there were also people feeling like we needed some other types of housing models that were just not available at the time. And then lastly, that there was no chronic care model of treatment for people with complex care, that many people who are accessing mental health services have triple diagnoses often, both mental health, substance abuse, developmental disabilities, TBI, that people also have a number of medical problems, and that we didn't really have a model of care that addressed that population. Some recommendations that came from the group I just want to highlight. We are going to be using this report as we look at the restructuring and redesign of state-operated services as well. The first recommendation was to design acute and intermediate care settings for people with complex behaviors and complex care. And the two groups that were most mentioned by both the work group and the steering committee were people who had medical conditions, and then secondly, people with aggressive behaviors who were just really having some challenge being in the community. That we needed to look at developing some housing with supports for those who needed 24-hour oversight and monitoring that would be home-like, that would be permanent housing, but people might need some staff on-site. The third was to expand the CIT training and the team statewide. People felt that was very helpful. And then the last was promoting telemedicine to address some of the workforce shortage issues. What the workforce group found was that it took about a year and a half to recruit a psychiatrist at minimum. So once there was a vacancy, it was about a year and a half. And they were starting to find that the same was happening for advanced practice nurses. So clearly a significant period of time waiting to recruit to fill vacancies. And when we thought, you know, telemedicine would be a way to partly address that. And then lastly, to fund and replicate the mental health medication assistance program. This is currently in place in the East Metro that's been very successful. It is a maximum of three-month program for people who are uninsured, people who have very significantly high copays, or people who just have no insurance coverage. And it provides medications through eight pharmacies in the metropolitan area at a reduced cost so that the copay is not charged to the client, for example. What they found is that it significantly reduces hospitalization and really is saving a great deal of money on the hospital side. The next was to realign service funding and regulatory processes for people with dual mental health and substance abuse disorders. I think it's a real challenge for providers who are trying to deal with the silos between mental health funding and substance abuse funding, and are there ways that we can begin to explore doing something different? And then lastly, expanding the intensive community rehab services to other regions of the state, which they felt had been very effective. And that concludes the adult piece. If there are any questions?
Ms. Audio, I just have a couple of questions.
Sure.
The first one is, in terms of the crisis service, is it possible to make that a Medicaid benefit?
Madam Chair, it is a Medicaid benefit, so we are covering that through Medicaid.
I guess the question I would have after that is then, why is it not available in more parts of the state, or why aren't there more crisis teams? I mean, if it's a Medicaid benefit, it should be available statewide.
Madam Chair, they are available throughout the state. I think one of the challenges is that you have to have a 24/7 365 program in order to be effective. And in many parts of the state, that really is a challenge in terms of finding staff to do this, for number one. And then secondly, most of the projects are finding that there's about a 20%, if not higher, uninsured population who come forward seeking crisis services. You know, people are not asking clearly, do you have insurance, before they address the crisis. So it's kind of a combination of the two. And I think the challenge is really, it's really the workforce issue. People have tried to do mobile crisis teams in greater Minnesota. Some of it's geography. If you think about some people who live really significant distances away, it really is hard to do mobile teams. But they've tried to do some modification of that model. But it still is a shortage area in some parts of the state.
So do they go back and do retroactive eligibility for MA to get the crisis service paid for through MA?
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. And that's what the healthcare navigators have been very helpful with doing.
And there's still 20% that are suffering from a mental health crisis that are not going to be MA eligible?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then I have another question, and that is, you know, I've been talking with you over the years about the no wrong door policy. Been talking to you for about 10 years, I'd say, about that. And so I'm glad to see that. That's really good. But I'm surprised to see that we have on our list of recommendations realigning service funding and regulatory processes, because whenever I've asked you, you've told me you've been working on that. And if you've been working on it for almost 10 years, I'm surprised it's on a list for recommendations.
Madam Chair, it is a challenge. A lot of it is federal policy. There really is a lot of reluctance on the federal level, at least in the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration arena, to do anything with looking at integrating funding.
But we do have some block grant funding that we have more flexibility about, and we are kind of more or less in charge of licensing, aren't we?
We are. I mean, Madam Chair, some of the regulatory changes, I think we can, and we continue to work on that. The block grant funding, however, is one of the challenges, because that's the part where we thought we would have some flexibility of doing some more blending of funding. And that's the federal block grant money that comes from the Substance Abuse and Services Administration. They are, they were at least not very interested in doing that kind of blending. What they are interested in doing is braiding funding. And we've had some success in some parts of the state with providers trying to braid funding. But it's been a very real challenge for us. I think we're starting to make some inroads into that process, but it really is a challenge for providers. And I'm hoping that at least in 2 years from now I can come back and say we have solved this problem. But a lot of it is really federal requirements.
Well, maybe you could get me some more information about that.
Sure. I certainly would be
willing
to do that.
You know, because if we need to be working with our federal partners, we need to be letting them know what they could do about it.
Yeah.
Other questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Audio. I have a question, a kind of a general question, related to the governor's cuts to LGA and the impact spending at the local level, the county level in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Is having, or those cuts and decisions being made at the county level are having with regard to mental health services. For example, in Beltrami County, one of the counties in my district, the sheriff's department recently announced that they're no longer going to be transporting mental health patients, which is a service that they've traditionally provided. And in that county, they've decided not to raise property taxes, but apparently to eliminate services to keep property taxes level. And so we see the elimination of certain services the county has traditionally provided. And what I'm seeing is that they tend to be in the areas, or at least that particular service is certainly in an area where not only is a vulnerable population going to be impacted, but we're going to see shifting of cost to more expensive services, perhaps ambulances or, you know, other kinds of law enforcement, or we're just going to have people not able to get to the services they need. So I'm just wondering if you've seen that kind of thing happening anywhere else in the state, and if not just with transportation, but if there's anything else that's being impacted we should be aware of.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I am aware of the situation in Beltrami County, and we have been working with them to look at what other alternatives there might be. I've not heard that similar sort of situation in other parts of the state. Not that it may not be there, but I've not heard about the situation most particularly of the police no longer transporting people. I think there is pressure on the local level. We do have a maintenance of effort requirement for mental health services in statute, and I think that they, you know, we have put in significant, I think, at the state level investments into mental health, and really have worked very closely with the counties in terms of that investment as well. It's hard to, you know, tell, and I think what happens is we tend to then focus, even I did, on the intensive services where there may be many earlier intervention services that might be more effective. I think that the counties are getting better with billing Medicaid. I think that was also an issue for some time, that we moved a lot of services under Medicaid, and there's been some billing issues, and that certainly helps because they're getting federal revenue for that particular service. If I hear anything further comparable to the Beltrami County one, I guess.
Madam Chair and Senator, if I can add an additional comment on that. The issue around transportation has come up not only regarding the finances of it, but also just the difficulty on law enforcement providing transportation. Also, from an advocacy perspective, the issue of just stigma of being transported by law enforcement just because you have a mental illness requiring hospitalization. And so for a year that I've been in this role, I've been hearing this issue coming up in multiple different manners across the state. One of the things recently that has been brought forward in conversation is the role of mobile crisis centers, because they are providing in some areas in the state some degree of transportation and some degree of outreach into emergency rooms as well. I think that there might be a new model of transportation that can emerge out of further discussion, but I think it has to be examined. We certainly hear from the Ambulance Association, from the Sheriff's Association, from the Chiefs of Police Association, the pressures that they feel on the transportation issues. I think when Mr. Tesner comes up, he might have more awareness of other areas around the state that have experienced something similar to the Beltrami County.
Well, I don't quite understand how they can do a 48-hour hold if they don't get a determination by a medical professional that the person is dangerous.
Madam Chair, I think what I understand about Beltrami County is that once somebody is in the emergency room and is placed on a hold, they have to rely on law enforcement to provide that transportation. And law enforcement, our understanding is now saying we can no longer do that.
So they'll have to rely on where?
To an inpatient hospital facility. So
where is the emergency room? Isn't it in a hospital?
But the emergency room in Bemidji, for instance, as just one example, doesn't have an inpatient psychiatric unit. So they would, if somebody requires inpatient hospitalization, they got to be transported someplace.
I see. Okay. Other questions on this adult presentation? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Audio, it was encouraging to hear that in a number of instances you were realizing some positive impacts in terms of hospitalization and related services. So I'm wondering if we have or we can anticipate seeing those actual savings occur on paper is one question that I have. And the second question is, with regard to your key findings and your recommendations of the task force, do you have the resources within the agency to be able to move forward with those recommendations?
Madam Chair and Senator Lynch, the savings piece we could certainly look at. I think that there are costs as well to providing some of these other services too, so we have to balance the two. And some of the costs are not just in the human services side, and that always becomes the other piece, is that, you know, if you look at the ACT teams, for example, there are savings with law enforcement, there are savings in other areas. It's sometimes are really difficult to also enter into the equation, but we are certainly going to be looking at that. With respect to your second question about do we have the resources, we probably, within the department, I would say not to do all of those, but I think one of the things that we have looked at is this an opportunity to look at some key ones and then do those in collaboration with our county partners and our redesign of state-operated services, for example. I think that some of these may be readjusting how we're doing some service and looking at doing some things differently. The housing development is a real challenge for multiple issues. One is that there's a lot of not in my neighborhood that's happening now, so trying to site housing options is becoming more and more challenging. We've just heard of another instance where people were trying to site housing for people with a range of disabilities, and there was real outcry by the community. And then the other is just the development time. It takes 3 to 5 years to develop any kind of housing. It's starting to be better now because the tax credits are available, but in the past, housing developers were not interested in moving forward with development, and they want to be sure that this service package is there so that they don't develop housing and then not have the service package available for people. So some of these are going to be some challenges. I think there may be some partnerships that the state can do with some private providers in the community and some other kind of creative ways to look at moving forward with some of their key recommendations. We've been very successful, I think, with doing some really innovative public-private partnershiping, and I'd like to see that continue as well. Our clients move between the public system and the private system, and the more collaboration that we can do across systems, I think, the more effective it is for consumer services.
Ms. Audio, we also would encourage you to talk with the long-term care division in your department, because just this week we heard that they didn't issue a bulletin, they haven't promulgated a rule, but they have sent a letter out to counties telling them that housing with services in apartment buildings, you know, it used to be that if you had, you couldn't have more than 4 people in an apartment building, in an apartment. Now they're saying the roof of the apartment building can't have more than 4 people under it. And this has caused all development that was in the pipeline at the county level to come to a grinding halt. And I can't imagine, I mean, this is going to be nothing but more expensive if all these folks have to be in group homes instead of in apartment buildings with services. So we all need to talk.
Madam Chair, we will definitely have that meeting. I think that's thank you for bringing that to our attention. I have one additional comment, if that's okay, in response mm-hmm. to that last question. Right now, we still are collecting the 2008 data on total costs. So the 2007 data, when I looked at that, when you look at the total inpatient cost across the entire state for public dollars, public mental health dollars for adults, it was nearly $255 million in that range. Out of a $550 million total expenditure for all public mental health dollars in the state, that's including Medicaid, the whole expenditure. We already are seeing that there is a trend down in 2008.
So my sense is we will see actual dollars. We'll be able to come back and show you that there's some significant differences once these services that were put into effect in 2007 got implemented in 2008 at a much more widespread level. I think we'll be able to come back with some real dollars to show some trend and some savings that occurred.
Good. Other questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is about the crisis intervention team, Ms. Audio. And it says here you train 235 officers in 39 counties. If you could explain just a little bit more about that, how they were trained. Did they have to come into the department? Did you go out to train them? Who paid for the training? And is your goal to get all of the counties involved in? Can you explain a little more about that, please?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, the way that the training occurs is that we there's really two groups that do training, and there's a group of law enforcement individuals in Minneapolis who have formed sort of a CIT crisis intervention team training component. And what we found is it is really effective, excuse me, to have law enforcement train law enforcement. And they actually have, it's an 80-hour training, or 40-hour training, excuse me, 40-hour training, and it's law enforcement training other law enforcement officers. They also contract with a professional or semi-professional acting group who actually enact situations that the law enforcement officers might find on the street that is very moving and very real, and they have to role play. So, it is helpful to have it with law enforcement teaching other law enforcement people. That's what we've done for the law enforcement people in the area. It's been very effective. Barbara Schneider Foundation also does some training as well. They also use law enforcement. The dispatchers get about a 4 to 8 hour training, so theirs is much more limited. But what we found is that if you don't train the dispatchers, when the calls come in, they don't know who to call. In terms of the funding, one of the things that we were able to do, we provided funding to the local areas. And in the local areas, they really did different models. One of the things we found is that in small towns, for example, or small counties, they can't free up their law enforcement people to go for a day because they wouldn't have anybody there. So we've been able to either, the local people have been trying to do training in smaller sites so that it's closer to home. In some instances, we've used some funding to help them backfill a position for a day or two to free up law enforcement, and that's been very effective and not at a lot of cost. So we're really effective in doing that. There's interest in doing this in parts of the state that we were not able to fund. One of the pieces that we are requiring is that there be a partnership with the mental health people, because I think the most effective part of the CIT training that came out of Tennessee was it's not just training law enforcement, it's also the collaboration with mental health in doing some work. And I just heard in Ramsey County that they are really very committed now to this process and have someone in their office next to the chief of police who is focusing on the mental health side. So it's really been very effective.
Madam Chair. Ms. Audio, did you say who paid for this?
I'm sorry.
Who's paying for this? Is it coming out of the funds or through the counties?
It was through some of the, Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, the funding was through the Mental Health Initiative. Yes. We had some funding for that to move this forward.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Audio. I wonder if there's any discussion or if there's been, or maybe it's a part of their standard training. I'm not sure, for ambulance personnel. Something similar than what we're talking about with law enforcement. I'm just thinking of a situation that happened in Bemidji this last summer. Again, we think about what happens in our area that we hear about, where I think an ambulance was the first responder to the scene, and because of the situation they found, law enforcement ended up having to be called. And unfortunately, in that situation, the young man involved was shot and killed by the police. And I don't think I don't think there's been any, I think there was an investigation, and I don't think law enforcement was determined to have done anything wrong, but I'm sure in retrospect everyone looks at that situation and wonders if it might have been handled differently. And, you know, the kind of thing we'd like to try to avoid, getting someone help rather than, you know, ending up in that situation.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think that the CIT training is probably not the appropriate type of training for ambulance people. But I think that we, you know, we have done some training of emergency response individuals. So I think that there's probably clearly a need to do more of that and to maybe gear the training for the ambulance drivers and ambulance companies so that they're more sensitive to this issue. I think the way that the CIT training is set up probably is not the best model for law enforcement or first responders. But clearly, I think you've identified a need that we need to address as well.
You know, Senator Olson, there was a whole task force about 2 years ago that the EMT board had put together on this issue, because when communities have volunteer ambulance service, they obviously were having difficulties knowing what to do. Not only if you are the first responder, but just in terms of transporting individuals that might have been identified with them who are in a mental health crisis. So it is an ongoing issue, I know. Are there other questions on this part of the presentation? If not, let's move on then.
Great, thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to ask Dr. Glennis Edwall to join us. She's the director of our Children's Mental Health Division. Oh, we need Tom. Yes, Tom.
Yeah, okay, that's right.
Code.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Glennis Edwall, director of Children's Mental Health, and I want to talk quickly, but hopefully helpfully, about sort of parallel issues in the Children's Mental Health Division as we've made our infrastructure investments from the 2007 Mental Health Initiative, and then some of the recommendations from the Intensive Services Needs Task Force report that Ms. Audio just described that are specific to children. There are six programs that we have been letting grants in under the 2007 infrastructure investments that were passed by the legislature, for which we are very grateful. They have really done some significant work to begin to build mental health services across the state. And I'll try to describe each of them fairly quickly, but hopefully in ways that give you a glimpse of what they're up to. We do children's services a bit differently, and you'll really see, I hope, through this, a thread of trying to make sure that we are intervening as early as possible with children and adolescents so that we can help to build their resilience and to get them back on a developmental trajectory that's appropriate as quickly as possible, that we try to build access to services in places where kids and adolescents are already receiving other services or are just part of their daily activities, and then really attending to the quality of our services and making sure we're getting the outcomes that we need. So the first of these programs that I want to talk about is school-linked mental health service grants. This is far and away the most popular in terms of the response to it that we have seen of any of the programs that I'll describe today. Communities are really hungry for it and keep asking, don't we have more money that we could put into this? And we have tried to make these monies go as far as we can. We have 21 current grantees. The grantees are community-based mental health agencies who are certified for children's therapeutic services and supports so that they can deliver their services in community settings, that they can make appropriate use of mental health practitioners under supervision, and so that their services can be offered year-round and aren't tied only to the school calendar. And that's been very successful. Most of those grantees cover large geographic areas because they are in greater Minnesota or in the metropolitan area. They cover multiple schools within, for example, a single district as in Minneapolis. But they serve more than one school in all cases. The services are either directly located in the schools or are linked to the schools but provided in a home or community service settings that are more appropriate to kids and families. But every RFP that we got in response had to show evidence of clear interagency coordination between the school and the mental health providers so that teachers are also being offered consultation and training as part of the grant, and we get better cross-system coordination with regard to meeting the needs of kids. Children birth to 21 are served. A few of the grantees are actually focused on early childhood. And we expect in each grant progressive expansion of the proportion of services that are reimbursed by other sources so that the provider can actually expand the services that they are offering. And we're finding that already with some of our providers, that they're able to go into more schools in their areas because they've been so successful with reimbursement. So we're very happy about that. The evaluations are based on treatment outcomes and also on measuring increased access, since that was clearly one of the goals of this program. And this was the largest proportion of the funding from the 2007 initiative. So we're very grateful for your support of this program. Secondly, the Children's Mental Health Division also has crisis intervention grants, as does the adult. Our funding was really 2 years behind the adult in the sense that the Adult Mental Health Division began crisis services infrastructure development ahead of us with an earlier appropriation. But we have been trying to catch up and, in fact, have been trying in every area where we can to work with the adult crisis intervention program so that we can share expenses and overhead whilst needing clearly to have staff that are appropriately trained to really meet the crises of kids and adolescents and their families. Groups of counties and or tribes could apply for these grants, and we currently have 13 grants to regions, not to any single county, but 13 grants to regions that include 58 counties and 5 tribes. The monies go for infrastructure development, including hiring and developing staff, and then also, as Ms. Audio also has already referenced, paying for non-reimbursed services for children and adolescents who do not have insurance coverage for this crisis service. Our evaluation measures here include child and family outcomes as well as service capacity growth. We, too, have some preliminary data, particularly from the metro area where the services have been up and running the longest, that we're seeing a very similar pattern, that where the crisis teams go out and meet with a child and family, that about 12% of the cases lead to a hospitalization, as opposed to about 50% if the child or family presents with a similar kind of crisis picture in an emergency department. And so we're clearly beginning to have the impact that we are hoping for. The third program is one that's also been a very important part of the children's mental health system, although funded sporadically and quite variably around the state before these monies were available, and that's respite care. Our children's subcommittee of the State Mental Health Advisory Committee has for years asked for greater respite care funding from both counties and the state, and we were grateful for the first time to be able to actually grant state monies to a number of counties to increase their ability to provide respite care. Grants are going to 42 counties, again, on an RFP basis. We didn't have enough money to reasonably spread around the entire state, and so we asked for an RFP. The monies can go either for planned respite care that is part of a child's individual family and child service plan, or it may be in emergency situations where a brief period of respite care can really prevent a hospitalization or forestall a crisis. Eligible children for this service are those who are receiving Rule 79 case management, that is, by definition, who meet our serious emotional disturbance criteria. And part of that was because then they must have a filed individual family child and family service plan, and the respite could be part of that planning. The funds could not supplant a county's current investment in respite, which discouraged some applicants, unfortunately, but has made it possible for us to make this money reach as far as possible. And our evaluation measures for this program include child functional incomes, child functional outcomes based on the tool that we have begun to use across the state, the Child and Adolescent Service Intensity Instrument. Fourth, I've said many times in front of this committee and others that early intervention is the name of the game in children's mental health, and so we also have a small number of early intervention grants from this infrastructure investment money. We have 10 grantees that we tried to get applications from around the state as much as possible, so we have representation in 6 of the 11 economic regions of the state. Our grantees vary widely in this program, from community-based mental health providers and to tribal mental health entities, And the community-based mental health providers are sometimes very small practices, sometimes community mental health centers, so they range enormously. At least 50% of the money in this grant must go for direct clinical services that would not be otherwise covered by insurance, since we have a Medicaid benefit set that does cover children who are Medicaid enrolled for most of the clinical services for early childhood. The remainder of the money is for capacity enhancements, especially including training for mental health providers, many of whom, as part of their formal education, never had any experience with early childhood. And so we are really needing to do that training to a large extent by ourselves in the state, and also for consultation with other child caring agencies and programs in order to get the same kind of interagency cooperation and collaboration that we described for the school-linked services program. Evaluation here includes child clinical outcomes. The parallel form to the CASI is the Early Childhood Service Intensity Instrument that we're beginning to use in these programs, and also the agency's capacity to provide developmentally appropriate assessments and interventions. And I'll talk about that a bit more with regard to our evidence-based practices, because we're training all of the staff in these grantees in those models of service that are really appropriate to the early childhood population. Fifth is specifically our evidence-based practices grants. We're really excited about this. This is relatively small amount of money that I think we're getting enormous bang for our buck out of by finally working out a training program that's leading to real practice changes around the state. We are training successive cohorts of mental health agencies on a combination of things. One is our Minnesota evidence-based practice database, which unfortunately it would take me much longer to describe probably than you have time for today, but it's an extraordinary database that allows us to bring every practitioner who's trained into contact with all of the extant literature on children's mental health interventions and help them really tailor their treatment planning to the child's specific diagnostic and demographic circumstances. In addition, we have also been training on specific evidence-based practices that we have specific demand for in the state, especially trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy and parent-child interaction therapy, which is a therapy that was specifically developed for children in the child welfare system who have had experiences of trauma or disrupted attachments, and helping their parents and or their foster parents to really better understand and be able to deal with some of the behaviors that result as a consequence of that history. Our grants reimburse only training time for the clinicians. And so we aren't giving large amounts of money to any of these agencies, but we are trying to make it possible for people to free up their time to be trained. We do face-to-face training of supervisors with follow-up consultation calls for 6 months. And that means we expect each person who is trained to carry a caseload using these new practices that they have been trained in, and then to report on a dashboard system on the actual outcomes for their patients as they implement these new practices. The supervisors are then expected to do the training of staff under them in their agencies as part of their agreement with us. And the child outcome measures are continuously plotted on dashboards as that training proceeds, so we can see, as well as the clinicians can see, the tremendous change in both their performance clinically as well as what's happening for the kids. And the final grant category is culturally specific capacity grants. We're also very grateful for this. We have disparities in several cultural groups for children's services, children's mental health services, but particularly our American Indian and African American communities. And so we were very grateful to get some money to be able to buttress some of our providers that are specific to these communities and to help them train more professionals. And so the monies under this grant support unreimbursed treatment services in those agencies, as do all the other grants, but also training costs for professionals and practitioners who come from and serve diverse communities. In particular, we have focused on bringing newly graduated mental health practitioners into these agencies and reimbursing the time to supervise them so that they can gain licensure if they then will also continue serving either in that agency or another agency serving the same culturally specific population. Again, a relatively small investment that we feel is beginning to pay off in really helping the service capacity for these communities. So that is all that I had to say about our infrastructure investment grants. As Ms. Audio said, we have a lot of other activities going on around intensive services, but these are the specific investments that came out of the 2007 initiative. As with Ms. Audio, I want to talk just briefly about the Intensive Service Needs Task Force report as it applied to children. Some of the children's recommendations will overlap with what you saw for adults, but some are specialized. We heard much the same thing, though, in general, that Ms. Audio referenced, which was that when we started looking at what we had available and how it was being utilized, there was fairly clear consensus in the task force that we had adequate psychiatric beds, but what we often had was a problem with access to those beds because we had bed days that were being used inappropriately to maintain kids for longer than needed be the case when they really needed some other form of service in the community that was either not available or was difficult to access. And so I'll walk through a series of recommendations, but I think you'll see this theme over and over again, that we need both more and more specialized intensive services at the community level so that we can quickly turn around kids who are hospitalized or in some cases divert kids from hospitalization to more appropriate specialty services in the community. So first of all, a call for focusing more intensive services to specific needs. And you'll see a number of things here. Specialty services by diagnosis. One of the diagnoses that is mentioned just repeatedly throughout all discussions of this issue within the children's side is the autism or autism spectrum diagnosis, that these kids are often receiving mental health services, especially inpatient mental health services, along with kids with other diagnoses, but they may not be the appropriate services for them, and they need something more specialized and probably something outside the hospital. And so that is really the second bullet as well, specialty beds or specialty residential facilities that really cater to the needs of a particular population and can meet those needs more effectively and certainly more efficiently than having them in a general population mix. There was a call for adding more subacute beds or Psych 21, another Medicaid benefit. We have one subacute facility right now in the state with the capacity from a Medicaid reimbursement standpoint to develop more such facilities. And then a more specialized workforce, which is both a training issue that we are certainly part of the solution to, but need to work with many more community partners and university partners to develop that specialized workforce to really make these facilities a reality in our system. Secondly, just availability and intensity of community-based services at the more intensive end of the spectrum. One of them that was mentioned is what is often referred to now as Youth Act, as it's being implemented in other states. This is a Medicaid benefit that we do have passed in Minnesota and that is scheduled for implementation in 2011. We're getting technical assistance, particularly from the state of Maine, that has been successful in implementing this statewide and are excited about the prospect of bringing this here. Another is a very intensive case management service that might correspond to the kind of refocusing of ACT-like teams that Ms. Audio also referenced for adults, and perhaps we could do something similar for kids. Third, one that I think we can start working on very soon and have already begun talking with some of our partners such as hospitals, counties, and health plans about is improving discharge planning from hospitals so that we can make sure it, to the extent we do have services available, we can get kids as effectively as possible and as quickly as possible to other services that are appropriate to their needs. I've talked before about often between hospitals and counties, there's a sort of volleying back and forth about whose responsibility this is. I think the task force helped us to understand it's everybody's responsibility, and we need to work together to try to figure out how to get better planning. Fourth, increased referrals from crisis teams, as well as coordination between hospital emergency departments and crisis teams, both in the East Metro on the adult side, as well as a couple of counties that have this capacity on the children's side. We're really seeing even better use of our crisis teams when they can go directly into emergency departments and offer services there. And so are working with our crisis teams as they develop around the state to develop those relationships with their local hospitals so that they can do that. Fifth, increasing services that prevent the need for hospitalization in the first place. Again, this theme of the earlier the better when it comes to kids. And so the task force particularly named here increased respite care since often hospitalization is something that happens when a family has simply reached the end of their limit to be able to deal with a situation, and respite is a very inexpensive alternative to trying to forestall or prevent a hospitalization. The other that was mentioned by the task force is increasing the capacity of primary care to really handle kids' mental health problems in consort with specialty mental health providers as needed, but so that a child's primary care physician can be better equipped to notice when crises are developing and forestall them. And then 6 and 7 are really sort of keep it up. That is, things that we've been attending to since the 07 initiative, and we're grateful for, but that really need our continued attention, which is making sure that we really are seeing what the community funding needs are and putting our monies in the right places. And then I took as 7 as a compliment, but know that there's much more work to be done, which is attending to quality and performance issues and really keeping up our efforts in those cases so that we know always that we're getting the most effective service we can for the monies that we're investing. Thank you. That concludes my presentation. Contact information if you have specific questions beyond this day, but there are questions right now.
Dr. Ewald, the governor unallotted the county children's services grants. Is that correct?
I will need help with that because I can't remember what the exact proportion was.
Grant?
No. CCSA. The Children and Community Services Act, the portion that would go to counties.
There was a portion. John, you probably know the answer to that.
I'm going to defer to Mr. Zakel.
Sure.
Madam Chair, John Zakel, did you ask about the Children and Community Services Block Grant? Is that
right?
Yes. That.
As I recall, the governor unallotted that.
Yes, I believe you're correct.
And I'm just wondering if that's having an impact at all on the implementation of the children's portion of the mental health reform that we passed.
Madam Chair, at the same time that happened, the federal government match for Medicaid went up generally. And in the case of mental health, if you recall, the counties are responsible for the match on mental health case management. Now, in our discussions with counties, we looked at those numbers in terms of how much was the reduction in the block grant and how much was the increase in the federal match for county case management. And based on the proportion of block grant money that they'd been using for mental health before, that
decreased. There was an offset?
There was an offset. And so in our bulletin to counties on maintenance of effort, we pointed that out. We worked with the county work group. They agreed with us that, yes, that did appear to be true. And my understanding is that in most cases that is what has applied, that counties have used that increased federal reimbursement for case management to offset the reduction in the block grant.
Are there other cases of that within the department where there were reductions to the counties and it was being offset by temporary federal increased funding?
Madam Chair, we did that in adult mental health. In that case, the unallotment was actually in the adult mental health grants.
Maybe if we could get more information on that, because, there are some people around and about who think, well, all we have to do in the future is make the unallotments permanent and we'll have our budget crisis resolved. And I know that there were some things that were done with the idea that the unallotment was one time and there was something to offset it. So I think it'd be important for us to be able to keep track of that. And if we could get that from you, I mean, obviously we didn't have a lot of dialogue about this these unallotment decisions, and so I think if we could get some follow-up information, that would be helpful. Other questions on the children's portion? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm just wondering if you know if, And I'm assuming that this would have been looked at, but I thought with most of those federal funds that there were maintenance of effort requirements that the federal government had so that they wouldn't
maintenance
just be
maintenance of effort
supplanted.
Was on enrollment. You couldn't cut eligibility.
Okay.
And what was cut with the unallotment were state grants to counties. It had nothing to do with Medicaid.
Okay.
But apparently there was some Medicaid money that they felt kind of offset the cuts. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Mike Tesner, the CEO of State Operated Services, and also reinvite Sharon Audio, Adult Mental Health Director, back to the table.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Tesner. I'm the Chief Executive for State Operated Services. I'd like to cover three things this afternoon. One is I want to revisit the concept that we're operating under with State Operated Services as a specialty health system. I want to talk about the preliminary work we've done inside of the department looking at the redesign of State Operated Services. And then Ms. Audio is going to be talking about our plan to engage stakeholders in that dialogue and engage them in the planning for what those services will eventually look like. Once again, and you've seen these slides, so I won't dwell on them greatly, but State Operated Services occupies the far left part of the continuum of care, primary care of the far right. The community mental health system, the chemical addiction recovery system, is kind of in the middle, and we tend to share some of those responsibilities. But the state's role clearly is serving individuals with the most complex conditions. This graphic also demonstrates State Operated Services. The preponderance of folks that we serve are in the far upper right-hand, most complex, highest acuity characteristics. Oh, we're getting, hold on. Let me just go to, we share these individuals, of course, with the existing mental health system, as well as to some degree the primary care system. However, when individuals reach that highest complexity and highest acuity, they tend to and gravitate towards our system of care. The one characteristic that kind of overrides the clinical complexity or the acuity is the extreme acuity and aggressive behavior. And that group almost invariably ends up coming to State Operated Services' attention. This is, once again, the level of care prevalence data. When folks enter our hospital systems, we measure the acuity upon admission and a number of times throughout their stay to determine what level of care that they need. It also is a way of measuring their response to treatment. The blue part of the bar is representing the CBHH system, and the red Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. No data is reflective of either the individual came and went before we could collect the data, or the individual was not cooperative in collecting the data. So that isn't real helpful in this discussion, but there are that's what that no data references. Level 6 is indicative of individuals who do need acute inpatient care, and what you can see here is that the CBHHs, if you look at, level 6 is acute inpatient care. Level 5 is more of a step-down specialized residential where there's medical monitoring of the care but not direct hospital level. Levels 4, 3, and 2 are typically more community-based levels of care. Right now, if you look at the CBHH utilization, about half the population in the CBHHs need level 6 in acute inpatient, and about half need level 5 or lesser levels of care. Anoka, it's a little bit greater than that. It's about 60%. But what this represents is, as we studied the utilization of State Operated Services, we can see clear evidence that a different level of care provided this population would be more in line with what their presentation is to us. In other words, they'd get a better set of services than what they're getting, and we could reduce our costs because we would not be providing hospital level care for people who don't need a hospital level care. You've seen this slide before as well. This is starting at the bottom, people that are the highest complexity and acuity needing inpatient care, locus level 6. Locus level 5 gets a little bit into inpatient, but mostly it's into specialized residential or intensive residential treatment services, partial hospitalization. Level 4, 3, and 2 are much more on the community side of the service continuum. This graphic represents on the far left-hand side specialty inpatient, which we would characterize as the CBHH, is the role of state-operated services is really serving those individuals with the most complex on inpatient. Specialty residential is a set of services that we are conceptualizing at this point that would better treat individuals who are at that level 5 or level 4. Community inpatient is the existing community hospitals out in the community. Assertive community treatment teams, ERTs, those are the current services that Ms. Audio talked about earlier that exist out in the community. The importance of this graphic is that, you know, we're serving individuals at that far left-hand side of the continuum. However, at this point, we're relatively constricted because we're providing acute inpatient care. And as the locus levels have shown us, there's individuals who don't need that level of care, but they cannot get access to care in the community to meet their needs either. Current locations, this represents all of state operated services business. As you can see, we have almost 200 sites throughout the state, geographically dispersed, both adult mental health as well as chemical addiction recovery, DD services, residential and vocational, as well as the forensic services out of Security Hospital. As we've been looking internal within state-operated services, moving away from this notion that we simply provide a distinct acute inpatient set of services to a broader set of specialty care, still targeting that same population, conceptually we're looking at perhaps doing this in a regional fashion. So we would have in each region of the state an array of services that would be responsive to those individuals with the most complex conditions. I want to emphasize these are internal concepts at this point. We're in the process of rolling these ideas out, to the multiple stakeholders to solicit input prior to implementing any of these changes. That's a continuation. We're looking at not just adult mental health, but also the traumatic brain injury and cognitive developmental disorders. Primarily, we serve individuals through the Minnesota Neuro Rehab Hospital up in Brainerd and the MEDO program down in Cambridge. And the design of those services, we're also looking at how those may be impacted by the redesign of the adult mental health system. The stakeholder input process, this represents all the different parties that we are in the process of talking to, and Sharon will get to here in a second. Let me talk a little bit about where we've begun. Last session, of course, there was some legislation that was initiated out of this committee that eventually was passed regarding the restructuring of the Anoka facility and the MEDO program. Additionally, in July, the unallotment process identified redesign for state-operated services in greater Minnesota, in particular the CBHH system. We began in June meeting with a number of different community hospitals and providers across mostly greater Minnesota about the potential impact on them and their interest in helping us redesign this system and how it would impact in their services. We began talking with our staff aggressively in July through August, making sure they understood the impact, what the legislation said, what the allotment said, and that we would be engaging in this planning process so that they understood the pressures that we're under and what the planning process would be. We also began meeting this fall with key legislators, many of you folks in the room, to make sure you understood the intent of our process and kind of what pressures we're under and to try to keep the legislature up to speed on our efforts. Beginning in July, these are work groups that were internal to the department. Once again, looking at the population that we are now serving through our CBHHs and at Anoka and in the Minnesota Neuro Rehab and the MEDO program, looking at the complexity, where they come from, where they go, how long they stay with us. Those individuals who get stuck in our system and could really benefit from a different level of care. We came up with a number of potential service options that we convened working groups. The working groups were comprised of multiple staff throughout SOS as well as internal departmental staff to flesh out at least conceptually what these models could look like. This is not a roadmap to what we're going to do. It was intended to become a menu of services that could be brought into the conversation when we started talking about the redesign. The areas that we studied in these, the groups were charged with not just looking at the current population, but other models available throughout the country serving populations with these complex histories. The target areas we hit on were outpatient health care services or outpatient mental health services, partial hospitalization, intensive outpatient programs, consultative liaison services, a care coordination service, specialized residential with medical monitoring, public group practice, which was intended to look at how to organize our independent practitioners in the most efficient way to not only provide services, but as well as drawing down financial reimbursement for those services. And then the last working group is the neurocognitive service system of care. This is specifically targeting individuals with traumatic brain injury and developmental disabilities, now served through primarily the Minnesota NeuroRehab in Brainerd and Meadow, looking at how to bring that service system into a more sophisticated way of responding to that population rather than those two intensive inpatient settings. These working groups have completed their initial work, much of their ideas and the concepts are going to be shared in these regional planning meetings. Are you ready to start, Sharon, or is this?
No, this is yours.
This is still mine. Okay. Sharon and I are tag teaming this afternoon. In September, we began conversations with the MAXA group, ensuring that county social services directors were understanding what once again, the planning process that we intended to get engaged in, some of the pressures we were under, and make sure that line of communication was open. We also began discussing the potential changes with the health plans, in particular the ones that we are engaged with through the CBHHs and billing and collecting from. We began initial stakeholder meetings in October where we invited county representatives, hospital administrators, healthcare stakeholders, community mental health, and CD treatment providers to the table to talk about these changes and solicit input into what impact it may have on them and concerns that they may have, as well as potential partnerships in the redesign of the system with them. We also have had a conversation down with the Crest counties. This is the southeast corner of the state, 10 counties. Once again, with providers, county social service agency, consumers. We convened a roundtable with the Minnesota Psychiatric Society with, I think, probably 20 practitioners. Maybe it was more than that. Dr. Sulik?
It was more than that.
Statewide, both people practicing in ACT teams, for example, as well as inpatient settings, as well as outpatient settings, sharing these ideas, the pressures, once again, that we're facing, the concept of the state's role and soliciting their notions of how we should shape this redesign. The initial feedback that we've gotten, and this isn't the final word, but this is kind of a snapshot of things that we have heard from these meetings thus far, was to some degree an endorsement of the philosophy and of the redesign of the SOS system, focusing on that those individuals with the most complex disorders, and in particular individuals with complex disorders and violent behavior. There's a lot of discussion around the fiscal and management and payment structures that we'll be engaging in or continuing to engage in. Many questions came up about the planning and implementation. Many conversations about our need to partner and collaborate with other providers that are doing similar services. If you think back to the graphics, you know, there's a blend where the state's role as a provider and other providers really crossing over. So one of the themes we're hearing loud and clear is that we need to do that in collaboration, in partnership, perhaps new partnerships that don't exist today, to best meet those needs and build a stronger system. One of the themes that we heard is the state asserting its role in establishing standards of care, identifying supplemental resources, facilitation of best practices and professional education. A lot of concerns were raised around the legal and commitment process and some of the conditions or the constraints that puts on the way that we act. In particular, transportation came up earlier. In the CBHHs, about 30% of the people come into us under a peace officer's hold solely for the purpose of transporting the person to the hospital. So the only way that right now in Greater Minnesota, the primary way that people get to our hospitals is through a peace officer's hold. And I think as Dr. Sulik mentioned, the stigma attached to that, the cost attached to that need to come into question. Need for more housing options, of course, was mentioned. Transportation I just touched on. Services available to the criminal justice system. One of the pressures that has come over the last several years as the CBHH system came online, the RTC system downsized and went away. Jails and law enforcement personnel in Greater Minnesota continue to run into individuals when their mental health is not well managed, the criminal side oftentimes becomes problematic. There's not a lot of individuals with those characteristics, but when they present at the local emergency department or the local jail, it really is crippling the system. They present a risk to themselves and oftentimes others. These are not individuals who are probably going to end up in the mentally ill and dangerous side. They're individuals that once they get their mental health treatment, they stabilize very quickly and can return. This issue has come up in every meeting we've had, and it is one of the priorities, I think, for our redesign discussion. And then lastly, was a discussion of the need for monitoring quality and producing outcomes. You want to take control?
Yes, do you want to just hit this up easier, I think. I have the next two slides, and Sharon Audio, Adult Mental Health Division Director. I want to talk about two things. One is that in November and December, we've held two meetings with our advocacy communities, and they're listed here in terms of getting input from the advocates who hear from consumers, family members, as well as hearing what some of their concerns were as we move forward with this engagement of stakeholders, and I think input we got was extremely valuable and some very good input to the state to think about how we move forward with some regional planning efforts, as well as I think some very nice outcomes in terms of what the advocate group is saying. We would know that this was successful if these outcomes were met. Clearly, primary to that was consumer and family engagement, which clearly makes a lot of sense. That's who we are serving. We are in the process now of scheduling meetings starting in January. We actually have a meeting this December with the metro counties and the directors of the metro counties and some of the advocates to begin to look at how do we plan in the metro. There's been some cross-county partnership that's been happening in the metro. Other counties that perhaps want to do the planning and the implementation on their own. When you're talking about the metro, there are a lot of numbers of constituents that we need to keep in mind. So we're meeting with them next Monday to do some pre-planning of how to proceed with the metro area. And then in January and February, we have a set of meetings scheduled to go to visit all of the remaining adult mental health initiatives. Those are multi-county planning and implementation groups. Many of those are multi-county efforts, and we've been very successful over the past 15 years using that model to think about where are the gaps in the system, how can the state and the local providers and counties collaborate well with each other. Listed here, and I won't go through the whole list, but you'll see a list of people that we want to assure are participating in this. There's one that I would add, which is not on the list, which is the managed care organizations, because I think in many parts of the state we've done some very nice partnershiping with them, and they need to be engaged in this process as well. So we will be on the road probably 3,500 miles later having a summary of where we will go from there.
Yeah. Another aspect, and Sharon alluded to this, we've heard loud and clear that we need to particularly pay attention to consumer and family involvement. So we've been working collaboratively with the Consumer Survivor Network as well as the State Advisory Council on Mental Health and the local advisory committees to fashion, if you will, a focus group strategy, 8 to 10 participants statewide. It looks like at this point we're going to have about a dozen meetings in the Twin Cities and about a dozen meetings in greater Minnesota, specifically talking with individuals who have access services from state-operated services, getting a better understanding of what it is that what care and treatment worked for them, what didn't work, what their thoughts are about changes in the system. Not quite sure what that feedback is going to look like. This will be the first time that SOS has engaged in this type of a process. We've solicited input in many ways in the past, but this is a much more, I think, hopefully user-friendly process to solicit input. This also will go into the planning for the redesign. Employee engagement, as I alluded to earlier, we've been talking with our employees about the potential changes coming down the pike. Dating back to this past summer, we'll be initiating that again now that the planning process has become more mature. That'll start again in January, probably through February into March. Two things. One is giving them as much information as we can about the design process and what we know, but part of what they're listening for, of course, is any impact on jobs and changes in jobs. So we'll be sharing as much information as we can in that process, and we'll also be soliciting their input into how to make this process appropriate and user-friendly from their perspective, both in the context of the redesign of the system, but also in how we handle any job changes that are coming down the pike. Lastly, I want to talk a little bit about the budget pressures. As I've alluded to, our primary drive here has been looking very clearly and concisely at our utilization, the types of folks coming in and the types of services that they need, and where we think we can achieve some efficiencies in providing better care. That is being done in the context of a projected $15 million hole in our budget. Part of that is the unallotment. Part of it is the operation of our dental clinics, which we haven't fully resolved how those dental clinics funding is going to work for this biennium. Part of it is the staff compensation increases that are available the second year of the biennium that were not funded in our budget. So there's also a couple cuts on administrative cuts that were passed down from legislative action. So all told, those are approximately $15 million. We're attacking that in a number of different ways. We're aggressively looking at non-salary costs and expenses. We're looking aggressively at the way that we staff our existing facilities, the flexibility of that staffing, and to ensure that we have the right level of staff on any given day, both when we need more staff and when we don't need as many staff. We're also aggressively looking at on-call costs. Operating a 24/7 healthcare system requires that we have credentialed staff available for when we need to have a credentialed staff making decisions. We're looking at the most efficient and effective way to provide that type of clinical oversight and reduce the budget pressure. We're also looking at the use of overtime and finding more efficient ways to staff and reduce the amount of overtime that we're expending. But additionally, it is going to take this redesign in order to hit those targets. And that's built into our planning. So be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Madam Chair.
So Mr. Tesmer, I don't mean this comment to sound too critical, because I certainly understand the need for planning, and I certainly want you to be engaging stakeholders. But this timeline that you're presenting to us, leaves me really questioning whether you're going to meet the unallotment savings that were projected. And I say that also in the context of understanding that you overspent your budget last biennium.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the expenditure, the past biennium was driven primarily by the closure of the Agua Ching program, the delay in the closure, I should say, and the budget pressures built from there. And really, that's the primary driver of the deficit that we finished this past biennium with. As it relates to our current planning and those budget targets, as I said, those pressures are there. We are mindful of them, and we are making every effort to come into line with what we think needs to happen in order to balance, and also in order to redesign the system so that it is more effective in delivering the care that people need.
Well, a certain amount of time will be required just once the planning and discussion of the planning is done to make the change in the delivery system. And so I just have to express concern here about
Madam Chair,
being able to move fast enough to get this happening soon enough to be able to get the savings that are needed.
Madam Chair, I would just I think that's a very fair question, and I think we're very much aware of the pressures regarding the urgency of getting the stakeholder input process completed rapidly as possible and as effectively as possible so that we can move towards a plan that we're able to implement and sustain. So I just want to provide assurance that is something that we are very much aware of, the precariousness of the pressure that we're on given the time frame that we have in order to implement these kind of savings. But we are moving forward trying to accomplish that as effectively as possible. And I think I would say that it feels like this is really the only effective way to truly do it is to obtain the stakeholder input in the manner that we can as effectively and thoroughly as possible. So as Sharon Audio said, we have an enormous pace for the remainder of December and the month of January and February in which to complete this process so that we can come back to you all with a more specific plan by the end of February so that you know what has really been determined as the priorities of action. So,
can we get a larger copy of that colored regional map you had in your overhead since ours is not either in color or very large?
Well, Madam Chair, there's two reasons for that. One in which when you put a line on a piece of paper, it's often felt that it's something permanent. And we can certainly provide that to you. Just know that is meant nothing more than just to indicate that there's a concept of regions that makes sense in the state. Where those lines are is there is no there's nothing formal about them at this point. And I think that's this process of going out and engaging the regional mental health initiative, the adult mental health initiatives, which are these cooperative county-based regions across the state. I think how we determine the array of services in various regions is really going to be dependent on the result of these meetings. So I just caution that don't look at that map as something that we're
we give you permission to give us a different map at a future time, but
acceptable.
Being that this is your latest line of thought, we'd like to have a copy of it.
Got it.
Then just one last question. Well, actually two questions. When do you believe you will be operating a reform system?
Madam Chair, I believe that we have to be operating under the premise that we will begin implementation of the transformation of the system by the end of the spring. That doesn't mean that it'll be completed, but we have to begin the implementation and create the phases clearly before the end of this fiscal year in order to achieve the savings that we absolutely have to, yet also be accountable for the effectiveness in the care system that we are charged to create here.
And then the second question is, have the earnings from the reform proposal been built into the forecast?
Madam Chair.
I would hope not, since you can't even tell us how much they are right now.
Yeah, no, well, they're not, because there's no way to really forecast actual dollar amounts at this point in time. So, but we also are not able to, just to bring back how this works, is any additional revenue generated from a state-operated services goes back into the general fund. It does not go into a state-operated services fund, so we don't get credit regarding a budget deficit, regarding income that's generated.
Well, I understand that we don't know precisely a dollar amount, but you did have an estimate of earnings that you thought that the reform would be generating.
Correct. And Madam Chair, again, that's an estimate going into this process. That estimate will be more formalized by the end of February, and we can certainly get back to you with more specific details.
I hope you will.
Yeah.
Senator Cornyn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Tesner, you said there's a $15 million hole. Is that before or after the November forecast, the $1.2 billion shortfall that we're having or proposed to have? So could the number be larger than $15 million, or is that the number that you're thinking right now? Or do you understand what I'm saying?
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, the $15 million was derived from actions during the legislative session and the unallotment process. So it didn't have anything to do with the November forecast.
So, Madam
Chair. The November forecast has to, I mean, we have to generate $1.2 billion in additional savings someplace. So, you know, I don't know what the answer to that is yet, but it may involve y'all. Who knows? I mean, you know.
And then just, this isn't really a question. It's just more of a, you know, I've been on this committee 7 years, and all this seems so complicated and complex and confusing, and it just seems like we should try to figure out an easier way to provide service that, to me, just maybe it's just me. It just seems complicated. It seemed like when we wanted to go to the 15-bed hospital, I thought that was reform. And it seems like it's constant reform, which maybe is good, but I'm just confused on all this complexity of how, I don't know why it's got to be so complex. It just seems like we should be able to simplify the services that we provide. I don't know, that's just a comment on my part.
Well, Senator Coring, I think all these slides make it look a lot more complex than it is. The way it was explained to me is, instead of having as many community hospital beds, we would have more residential with intensive outpatient treatment. And one of the advantages of that, of course, is we don't have to get that certified by the federal government. Intensive outpatient service is already a Medicaid-eligible service. The other types of services that they're talking about really are providing more clinic services to people at discharge so that they can be discharged because of the difficulty of finding providers in the community. Sometimes they're backed up in our state-operated service hospitals. And even perhaps more ACT team services to be going with people into the community.
May I say something else?
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, and, you know, just allow me to just talk for just a minute or two. Right now, my community of Little Falls, Brainerd, and Crosby, they're all wound up thinking that we're going to put in a veterans nursing home, which I tell them that it's not going to happen, because if we put that in, it's going to be more operating costs, and we just can't, I don't know where the money's going to come from. And so I said to them, I said, number one, my dad's a veteran. I said, so if my dad, God forbid, had to go in a nursing home, I wouldn't put him in a nursing home in Fergus Falls or Silver Bay or Hastings or Minneapolis or Laverne, because I'd never be able to go see him. I'd put him in a nursing home in my city. where I live. I've got two nursing homes in Brainerd. I've got one in Little Falls, one in Piers, one in Crosby, one in Pine River. There's one in every community. Why not have a veterans wing onto the nursing home, because all the infrastructure is there, and have 5 or 10 beds or whatever and have a contract? Same thing with mental health. Why can't we? There's hospitals in every community. Brainerd, Little Falls, Staples, Perham. Why can't we somehow contract this and have so many beds in each hospital instead of having all these 15-bed standalone facilities where if somebody does need emergency room care, they're already there? Or, well, I don't know.
Senator Coring, I know that when these were planned, they did talk with hospitals in all the communities where these were created. In a very few cases, they got partnerships, but in most cases, the hospitals didn't want to have these connected to their hospital. And so they were built a few blocks away, you know, close proximity as they could. But, you know, you got to have hospitals that are willing to have mental health beds.
But if we made the offer juicy enough to them, where they would provide the service, then we wouldn't have to have all these. They'd be responsible for the employees. They'd be responsible for the facility, and we'd be.
We didn't even make them that kind of an offer. These were still going to be our employees. It was just the physical proximity of having our hospital wing attached to their hospital, and they didn't want to do that. I might just remind you also, things haven't been getting juicier lately.
That's good.
You always do it to me every time. That'll be the line in the paper.
I wish they were getting juicier, but they're definitely not. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to offer a resource, perhaps, too. But down in Winona, we have a stakeholder model that started on a pilot project several years ago and really could be rolled out across the state, I think. But we have a group of people down there, and it was started because of the criminal justice system intersecting with mental health. And it's the Criminal Justice Joint Coordinating Coalition or something like that. But they have all the stakeholders that you have on your list, as well as advocacy groups and public health, county commissioners, the court system folks, police officers from the street. Everyone meets once a month to come up with plans on how to best address discharge planning. And they're trying to reduce recidivism, of course, because we have the rotating door. And, you know, when you deal with people from housing and employment and some kind of services instead of just opening the door after they've finished their time in jail and they have no medications, no place to go, put them out on the street, they're going to wind up right back in the jail. So this coalition has been working really well in Winona, and I'd be happy to either, Madam Chair, ask them to come up and testify about how it's working down there. But it's a great, it's a result of a pilot project that's got going. They ran out of money. They're still doing it because it saves money. It's better for the patients. The recidivism has been decreased. And, you know, you're talking about efficient, effective delivery systems. You might be able to skip some of those long steps we're worried about in the timeline and pick up the pace a little bit if we don't have to recreate the wheel.
Great. Thank you.
Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank you, Mr. Tesner and Dr. Sulik, for the work that you are doing on this. I serve 5 counties, just probably a little more than all these people over here, but we've all got a lot of counties. And you talk to any of the law enforcement, the sheriffs, and this is the number one issue. And I'm sure you heard that in your meetings, too. This is breaking our counties. And all you need is one case where there is a mental health patient that commits a crime and then gets injured. And they don't know where to put them out there. And it's breaking these counties. And they pray that they move over a mile and go into another county. That's basically what's happening. So if we can round this up and get some collaboration and some direction and some help here to relieve these counties, that's going to be a tremendous help. When you're talking about MOEs and the cuts to the counties and all this, this is the number one issue where they are just begging for help.
Okay. Excellent.
Any other questions? Well, I'm sure we'll be seeing you again about this. Good luck.
Thanks.
The next on the agenda is Alex Bartolik from the Disability Services area of the Department of Human Services. And I thought since we were asking them to plan to apply for a waiver for people with mental illness to be able to receive a PCA-like service, that we should get an update on how they're doing with that for people with mental illness.
Madam Chair, I am Alex Bartolik. I'm the Director for Disability Services, and I have a question in light of time. Some of the slides that I was going to go through talk about the implementation of the PCA program changes so far, or I can just focus on the...
We don't want to talk about the whole PCA change. We're focusing on where we're at with people with mental illness, because that was the biggest unknown, really, in the legislation. It was buying you some planning time so that you could try to figure out a different service for them so that we wouldn't be relying just on physical disabilities as the PCA program was.
And I'll go to the last slide and, walk through a little bit of what we've been learning about some of the alternatives. The changes to the PCA program around access to services did mean that we were adding additional criteria for people to use PCA services. Starting in January, people will need to have one dependency in an activity of daily living or intervention for a level one behavior. But then in July of 2011, they will require two activities of daily living. And the analysis last year during the session showed that there were a little over 2,000 people that would no longer be able to access PCA services as a result of these changes, and that about 66% of those individuals did have a mental illness. So there was legislation to have us look at alternatives to PCA. So we are looking at what options are going to be available, and one of the things that came up was the 1915I, which is a recent authority that CMS, the federal government, has made available to states to offer home and community-based services as a state plan option to individuals. This would allow us to have certain services that currently you can only get under a waiver, one of the home and community-based waivers, that you could get them under a state plan option. There are some restrictions in the current guidelines that, when we looked at it a couple of years ago, weren't quite as attractive in Minnesota, given what we had at that time. For example, there can only be one 1915I in a state, so whatever you decide to target as far as your services and the functional needs you are trying to meet, it has to cross over. You can't target by a particular population. There were different income limits than our traditional MA waiver programs that we have that would limit income at 150% of federal poverty. So there were some people who currently qualify for CADI services or DD waiver services who wouldn't be able to access a 1915I. The 1915I requires a functional assessment, so based on what people's needs are, and the criteria has to be at a lower threshold than institutional level of care. And in Minnesota, currently, our nursing home level of care is pretty broad, so it's kind of hard to find where people would be not eligible for that and still able to meet this. Being able to access this with the nursing home level of care, nursing home level of care changes that was passed last year and will be implemented in 2011 at the conclusion of the MOU with the stimulus funds, then that opens up the door to have a package of service that would be open for people who would not otherwise be eligible for that nursing home level of care. The state does have the ability to limit some kind of enrollment, so we can decide on our caps. So in essence, there's some options for this as we go forward, in that if we came up with a functional assessment that looked at the kind of services people would need because of mental health or behavioral needs, where we could target this service on that broad basis and limit some of the eligibility. One of the factors that we're taking into account is the 1915I is changing form through the healthcare debate on a national level. And so, for example, and it keeps shifting depending on the different versions, so we really need to see what comes out of it. There may be the ability, for example, depending on what passes, for there to be more than one 1915I, which means we could talk about the functional needs of somebody with mental health or behavioral needs and what services meet those needs and still potentially have the ability at another point in time. There might be the potential to target services, so we could actually get more specific about who we want to be able to receive these. But along with that, it looks as though there may be an inability to limit the growth or the enrollment in the program the same way we had before. So those are some of the pros and cons that we've been going through with this. We have been talking with other states and trying to watch what's coming on to look at the advantages to this. We also are will be seeing the beginning of the actual implementation of PCA changes around access and authorization of services that begin in January. So we'll be monitoring that to make sure we're understanding for sure who is being affected by this. And our goal is to have a plan that we can present in a year and that would be ready for implementation in July of 2011.
But I guess my concern with that timeline is the time it would take to actually get the waiver.
We've been concerned about that too, but until we know what's going to pass on a federal level, we potentially, what we would like to do may change. So we are...
Well, I understand the dilemma also, but I guess I was thinking you would have to get specific authority from the legislature to submit a waiver this session. So that it could, I mean, it usually takes a year to get those things.
Okay. You know, I think based on the legislation, we thought we were to come back with a plan to implement it. So we missed that step, and we can bring in recommendations based on the best thinking we have this session.
Okay. Are there any questions?